Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Consider This. Please let me know what you think and tell others about us on social media. This podcast was originally broadcast live on Northumberland 89.7 FM. You can hear this show live every Friday at noon. Thank you for downloading this program, and I hope you enjoy it.
Hello and welcome back. This is Consider This Northumberland, and I'm your host, Robert Washburn, and you're listening to Northumberland 89.7 FM. It is as if you want to give your head a shake. In the middle of the pandemic, more people wanted to join a union. In fact, the number of those wanting to join a union peaked when the pandemic was at its height. My next guest is not surprised. She would argue that there's lots of people who want to join unions. It's just that it's really hard to do that these days. Professor Stephanie Ross, along with her colleague Professor Larry Savage, recently wrote an article explaining many of the barriers people are facing trying to join a union. Ross, who is an associate professor and director at the School of Labor Studies at McMaster University, suggested the pandemic has people rethinking their relationships towards their work and their employers. The results could be some sizable shifts, and there is lots of evidence in Northumberland to suggest she is right. Here is my interview with Professor Stephanie Ross. I'm so pleased to have with me today Professor Stephanie Ross, the Associate Professor and Director of the School of Labor Studies at McMaster University. Welcome to Consider This.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
You recently wrote an article for The Conversation Canada called "The Advantages of Unionization Are Obvious. Why don't more people join unions?" Why write about this topic now?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. I mean, it is an enduring topic. We in Canada have had a unionization rate of around 30% for most of the last 40 years. And that since the 1990s, our unionization rate has sort of been stuck at that level. And, you know, there's been a lot of economic and social change in that period. Issues around the growth of economic inequality, around job loss, around the restructuring labor market. And so it kind of raises the question, well, why isn't it that over this period of time, we haven't seen a growth in unionization as a way to respond to a lot of those issues that are creating some pretty significant dislocation for people in their personal lives, in their ability to earn income, their ability to have a stable life based on good jobs. So it is kind of an enduring topic. Of course, as most people will know, Labor Day is coming up. And so that is also obviously a moment in the year to reflect on questions of labor, employment, on workers' rights and dignity. But we also are living in a very specific moment right now with respect to the impact that the COVID-19 pandemic and, you know, responses that employers and governments have had to that pandemic. And its impact on work and on the organization of work, on the way that labor markets are functioning, the way that people who have been pushed out of work are being supported, whether that's adequate or not. And also like what's happening in the workplace as people, some people are still employed, obviously quite essentially so, in order to keep society going. And the issues that those workers are facing, particularly essential workers, but also, you know, workers in a whole variety of jobs that are now being done remotely, there are all kinds of dynamics that are taking place at work that raise the question of what difference unionization makes to helping people navigate and be protected from the worst impacts of the pandemic on their working lives and, of course, on their personal lives, their financial security, et cetera. So we thought that it was a good moment to raise this issue again and to maybe review some of the conventional wisdom about why people aren't unionized, but also maybe to add something different to that conversation, to get people thinking about why It actually is quite difficult, even in Canada, for workers who want to unionize to get unionized. In the last 40 years, it's become more difficult.
You've said a lot of things that I deserve to be unpacked. So let's start to get down into the weeds. Can you describe what you see as the benefits of belonging to a union, and tell us, based on that, why is it so few do not belong?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, we generally call this phenomenon the union advantage. So it's very clear, we can demonstrate statistically that unionization means that, you know, on the bread and butter side, people make higher wages than their non-union counterparts. They are much more likely to have access to extended benefits like dental care, vision care, pensions, a host of other kinds of benefits. If you look at Statistics Canada data in 2020, the average hourly wage for people who were covered by a union contract was $32.66 an hour. For non-union folks, that their average wage is $28.08 an hour. So that's 28% more in wages if you are unionized. That doesn't necessarily take all of the various kinds of factors into play, but as a sort of a large scale understanding of the difference, it gives us a bit of a picture. And if you look more specifically at wages according to different categories of workers, the union advantage is even greater. The more disadvantaged a group of workers is in the labor market for various reasons, the greater the advantage is of being unionized. So if you look at temporary workers, the difference between their wages is, you know, $29 an hour unionized versus 20 an hour non-unionized. So it's 39% more if you're a temp worker who is unionized. If you look at women, if you look at racialized people, if you look at young people, all of those folks who also experience other forms of discrimination in the labor market benefit from a greater advantage to unionization. So there's some equity aspects to unionization that are really important, that unions actually create more equity between men and women, between white workers and racialized workers, et cetera, because they tend to standardize and flatten wage hierarchies. And they take the arbitrariness out of the way that good things and bad things are distributed in a workplace. So I'd say the second major advantage under unionization is one that's a little bit more difficult to show with statistics, but it's that workers who are unionized have a capacity to collectively shape and regulate the rules by which they are governed in their workplace. So there's an ability to have some meaningful voice and say over their working conditions, and that the law backs that say up with legal union status. And it means that people aren't isolated and played off against each other in the way that often is the case in a non-union environment. And people can speak up about problems in their workplaces with less fear of reprisal, less fear that the employer is going to punish them for speaking up or raising concerns or raising criticisms. In other words, unions make the workplace more democratic. They give workers a voice that isn't just sort of at the behest of the employer. Like if the employer's feeling nice, maybe they will do certain things in the non-union workplace if they decide it's a good idea. But unions allow workers to have some power behind their voice and some protection when they use that voice. And that's something that I think a lot of people are increasingly experiencing, that lack of say or power over their working conditions, and that I think is what's driving people to think and to consider unionization as a response to a lot of the problems that they've been subject to and that have really intensified in the period of the pandemic.
The pandemic has pointed out a lot of issues within workplaces. And I'm wondering if, from your perspective, you could point out some of the issues that you have seen emerge during this time.
For sure. Yeah. I was in collaboration with a number of other researchers at McMaster. We did do a survey last fall of workers in Ontario to try to see like what impact the pandemic was having on a whole set of aspects of their work lives, their income security, and also their, you know, social and psychological health. And the findings from that study, which people can access on the Labor Studies at McMaster website, laborstudies.mcmaster.ca under the research tab, showed us that in summary, that, you know, not surprisingly, you know, work is becoming less safe and more anxiety producing for the vast majority of people who participated in our study. And that that there was an important relationship between the extent to which key safety measures were made in workplaces and whether those workplaces were unionized. So even though people were feeling more anxious and unsafe, unionization meant that it was more likely that people were allowed to work from home, were provided with personal protective equipment, that more cleaning staff were hired. And so even though people felt unsafe, even in unionized environments, and probably that's also because lots and lots of essential workers are unionized, right? Like the healthcare workforce is, you know, has a unionization rate in the 70% range. They were also more likely to be able to access safety interventions at work than their non-union counterparts. So that's one thing that we saw. Another thing concerns job loss. And so, you know, a lot of times people talk about how, oh, you know, of course people don't want unions because if you unionize, you're going to lose your job. Well, in fact, what we saw in the pandemic was that people who were unionized were much more likely to retain their jobs during the pandemic than those who were not unionized. And this has to do with sector as well, because, you know, we have a lot of people who are unionized in the public sector. Those jobs continue and need to be done. And lots of people in retail and restaurants and, you know, public, like private services that are public facing that were shut down during the pandemic. But in the private sector, unionized workers were much more likely to keep their jobs than non-union workers. Lots of respondents to our survey told us that they felt that that some employers were taking advantage of pandemic conditions to push people to work harder, to cut people's wages, to engage in behavior that they maybe couldn't do in pre-pandemic times. And so, you know, this is not just exclusive to non-union workers. Many unionized workers reported that their employers were using the pandemic as an excuse to override collective agreements, to bully employees, et cetera. Now, bring that forward to where the debates that we're having today about as we reopen and people, many employers saying that they are finding it hard to find staff, et cetera. I mean, we don't know yet for certain what all of the pieces of this dynamic are. You know, the small business answer, like the Canadian Federation of Independent Business and others of that ilk, like to say it's because that government income supports are too high, right? CERB and CRB is too high. It's keeping people out of the labor market. I think there's something more complex going on here, that actually people are reevaluating their work lives, and they are reflecting on the treatment that they received from their employers and the experiences that they had of perhaps being forced to work in conditions that were quite unsafe without much regard to their health has led them to use the exit option and to go to other kinds of jobs or go back to school find other futures for themselves and exit, in particular, the low wage end of the economy. And I think that the treatment that people received is a factor in those decisions. We are going to embark on another wave of that study to try to probe those decisions that workers are making in more detail. But I suspect that what we will find is that people who were not treated well by their employers during the pandemic, they are seeking out alternatives and they are trying to go to better jobs. And we may see as the economy normalizes, whenever that's going to be, we may see a wave of unionization, although that it's too early to tell.
I wonder too, though, the amount of strife that you've described between employers and employees and working conditions, a lot of this stuff happens underground. We don't see it. You mentioned earlier that the only time we ever see unions or people talk about working conditions, it's not in the public realm. It's usually at home. We're upset about our job conditions or we're talking to friends, and the conflicts Absolutely. Between employers and employees happen well out of sight of everybody. And yet during the pandemic, the public support for essential workers, the grocery store clerks, the nurses, the doctors, the truckers, the emergency services, so on. Mm-hmm. How is this indicative of our ideas around work and labor and how we as a society relate to this whole issue of the workplace and mm-hmm. our rights and how we are important or not important?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think that we do have some. It was very interesting to see what you just described, to see the cultural valuation of jobs and people who are generally invisible and coded as unskilled or low skilled. And therefore kind of really deeply undervalued in our society. And it did feel like there was a moment of openness to rethinking some of the assumptions that we have about whose labor is valuable, and how does our processes of how we value people's labor translate then into like both economic and social status, right?
Well, can we explore that for a little bit? Because yeah. I really think that's critical in what you've been saying, because mm-hmm. Especially what you were saying about people who are now rethinking about going back to work. Mm-hmm. I know in our area, you can drive down some streets and there are literally lawn signs. We're hiring, big signs, mm-hmm. we're hiring. Everybody's hiring right now,
yeah.
and yet they can't find laborers. And I'm wondering if we're setting up for a new tension, mm-hmm. a cultural shift between, mm-hmm. you know, how workers have been treated up until the pandemic and now post-pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, I think the seeds are definitely there for that. And I guess what I would say is that the pandemic has been a transformative moment, I think. It has the potential to be a transformative moment in the way that the Second World War was a transformative moment for for Canadian society and many societies around the world, and in particular around the question of labor rights, because it was that moment where people said, hey, I've been sacrificing myself for not just for the last 6-7 years, but like, say, since the beginning of the Depression, I've been told that I'm fighting for democracy and freedom, et cetera, but I don't have any of that at home in my workplace. Like, I'm not actually able to benefit from all of this sacrifice. And that people were, as they came back from the war, they were like, we're not willing to put up this anymore. And that was when we saw this massive wave of unionization and the labor rights that and labor institutions that we still live with today. And so I do think that the pandemic is a potential moment for that kind of transformation. The kind of sacrifice that people have engaged in, the ways in which seeing loved ones die and be sickened and perhaps in a chronic way, I think has led people to reevaluate, like, what am I willing to sacrifice for a job or for an employer? And the question becomes whether or not people will feel like they have the collective courage to insist on something else. I think we are seeing people use their ability to exit bad situations right now, and it gives workers a little bit more power to have more choices. And you know, people, you know, on the business community side, they're upset about that, but here's the thing: the balance between workers and employers for the last 40 years shifted so far on the side of employers to be able to call the shots. Workers in the labor market were so constrained in the choices that they had, stuck in the low wage ends of the labor market. Now that there's a little bit of ability to choose something different, and I think a desire to do something, it does really raise questions about the whole structure of the economy that we've been kind of accepting for the last 20, 30, 40 years. And I think that, you know, there is a potential for a reckoning. Employers may need to, and consumers, who are also workers, frankly, consumers may need to accept that if you want to retain workers, you have to pay them a living wage and you have to treat them with dignity. And for the time being, workers may have more power to be able to say no, to refuse situations where they're not treated well. Whether that will remain permanent long enough for workers to create some new organizations, to be able to unionize, et cetera, that remains to be seen. But I do think that people are changed and in going back to the workplace, and they it creates a situation of, I think, uncertainty, a lot of potential. And so I want to be optimistic about it. But you know, there's still a lot of unknowns. And if we are now facing down a fourth wave, there's a lot of history still to be lived before we can know what impact these events are going to have on people's ideas about work and what they're willing to put up with at work.
If you could wave a wand and bring about change to the current system, what would you want to see done?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'd say that there are some labor law reforms that could be made that would make a big difference. For instance, the ability of employers to keep secret who are workers and to manipulate those lists is a big problem. I think that regulation of that and sharing of that information is important. I think that the lack of a framework for sector-wide bargaining is a huge problem, and that would make an enormous difference to thousands of workers in Ontario, if not Canada. I think that we also need to, so I would definitely want to see those kinds of changes. But I think that there is also a whole number of things that we need to do to improve people's lives that are outside of the workplace or that transcend all workplaces that actually we have figured out how to do and that reduce people's economic dependence on work. And that includes much better public services. We do, and that involves a rethinking of issues like taxation. There's an enormous amount of wealth in this country, and it is concentrated in very small, a small number of hands. And our governments have facilitated that concentration since the 1970s. And I think that there is an awareness of that. I mean, I think the discussion of like, you know, billionaires going to space has raised that issue in a very pointed way. It's like, if we have millions, billions of dollars sitting somewhere, but we do not have the collective capacity to decide how those resources are going to be used, you know, for social good, we have an obligation then to rethink our corporate taxation system, and not just in a country by country basis, but at the global level. So, I mean, if I had a magic wand to wave, I think I would, one of the first things I would do would be to radically alter the corporate taxation system so that we had significantly more money in public hands to be able to invest in our communities, to invest in things that we need to create more economic, social, and environmental justice. And I am convinced that the wealth is there and that workers have been creating that wealth with their very hard work. And I think that that would actually address the ongoing crises that we are going to continue to live unless we really do rethink those decisions and allow for a rebuilding of the public sector that serves the public good.
Professor Stephanie Ross, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure.
That was my interview with Professor Stephanie Ross, Associate Professor and Director of the School of Labor Studies at McMaster University. I want to thank my guests this week for talking to me, and I want to thank all the listeners for tuning in today. Please join me again next week when we will talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life and Northumberland County. So please tune in. If you would like to listen or share this or any podcast, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. There you will find past podcasts, news, and other information about life and politics in Northumberland County. Or you can go to the radio station's website at northumberland897.ca. I'm Robert Washburn. Thanks for taking time out of your day to listen in, and I hope over the week you will continue to consider this. Thank you for listening to this podcast from Consider This. If you have any comments or would like to suggest a story, please contact me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can message me on Facebook at Consider This. If you enjoyed this podcast or are looking for more news and information about Northumberland County, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. That's consider-this.ca. And don't forget to share. And again, thank you for listening and stay tuned for more from Consider This.